for the osteopaths.
As a lobbyist?
As a lobbyist. Mm-hmm. And he had gotten his degree at Boston University, where I had been, and so we very early on hit it off quite well. And I was down there being thoroughly beaten up by the legislators, who dearly love to tweak academics. And the then president, earlier the president of the University of Michigan, was Hatcher, who was a guy, I think, from literature, and he would try to lecture the legislature, which does not work. And so they kind of looked at all academics as being sort of other people. So they had been beating me up for, 40 minutes over our getting the medical school going and so on. And finally, I'd gotten to the end of my testimony, and they'd let me go, and I'd gone out in the hall, and I was visibly, just absolutely furious at the way that I'd been treated. And Jerry Favorman was a big, tall guy, about 6'6", came out. He put his arm on my shoulder, and he says, "Hell, Cantlin." He says, "When you go to the bank, you pay interest. When you come to the legislature, you pay an abuse. Get used to it. Which was some of the cagiest advice I had. It never bothered me again all of the time that I'd been there. And I did some testifying in Washington when I was there for the NSF budget, and later on for some of the other budgets. So
the Michigan legislative interviews were a tough one. They're good preparation for
good preparation for Washington.
Was there any opposition in terms of like organized med schools like at Wayne State
and
U of M?
Ann Arbor especially was opposed to it.
Yep.
And fought it tooth and nail. But fortunately at that time there was a great shortage of doctors. And so the medical schools were growing all around the country. Mm-hmm. Later on they had reason to believe they'd overdone it, but mm-hmm. at that time, not so. That's how the DOs came on, and it was kind of interesting that the osteopaths had no publicly supported College of Osteopathic Medicine anywhere in the country. They were mm-hmm. all private. And the state of California, a couple of years earlier, had made the so-called California solution, and you should interview Mike Magan, who's the dean of College of Osteopathic Medicine, has just stepped down. He's retired now. But he was the initial dean. And there's some things in my opus there that you'll find. But the DOs wanted to get a College of Osteopathic Medicine supported in the public. When the California legislature decreed that every physician practicing in the state of California would have to pass the standard board examinations. Nobody could practice medicine that hadn't passed those boards. So the DOs could go and take the board exams, and if they passed, they stayed there as licensed physicians. Well, the DOs felt that that was going to eliminate the DO profession in California, so there was a big exodus. Many of them came to Michigan. And Michigan had a very high number of DOs, and they got into the legislature. And I won't go into the details of that, but they eventually got real strong friends there. And Garth, what was his name? I'll think of it. But anyway, chairman of the Appropriations Committee, Gar Lane, chairman of the Appropriations Committee, had been badly injured in World War II, leg injury. And he was very derogatory about how the MDs had handled his injuries and the recovery from his injuries. And he had gotten to know a DO who had treated him like a person. Mm-hmm. Military MDs, and I have a cousin who was one, and our old family doctor had been a World War I Army surgeon are not famous for their bedside manner. Mm-hmm. So anyway, Garlane liked the deal, and so he gave them an inside entree, and so they eventually got the DO school started here. So I was involved very much in getting the DOs here.
Was there any difference in terms of focus that MSU could offer in that?
Well, we insisted that the students who went into these two schools have all of the basic sciences together. No separate basic sciences. Physiology of human beings is the same whether you're a DO or an MD.
That's right.
And so, having made that, then we Bill Knisley, who is now, I'm not sure whether he's still alive or not, but he left here. Bill Knisley was the director of biology and medicine and was the key point at which our existing veterinary medical school and the two-year program articulated with the DOs. And I was committed to keeping the medical schools internal to the university and not allowing them to be separate as they are on all other campuses. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
With the understanding that, and this came from Hannah's initial approach to getting the medical schools here, he wanted the Michigan State Medical School to be land grant in its focus. In other words, the central focus shouldn't be on improving the arts of medicine and the science and the technology of medicine. It should be centered, as the land grant philosophy said, on improving the health of the people of Michigan. Very land grant in its orientation. Now, if you have people coming out of the U.S. medical schools whose training is in this central research focus, you don't have the best preparation for the land-grant approach. Many of them would say, hell, that's a public health issue. Mm-hmm. Not a medical issue, it's a public health issue. Well, the reason public health is in the condition it's in is the MDs have ignored it all. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, the GPs and family practice.
So that's what we did. We made the emphasis on the GPs and the family practice. And I actively resisted getting a campus hospital. Mm-hmm. There were several attempts to get a campus hospital here. Last thing in the world we need is to have the medical school have its own darn hospital. They should learn how to work with the existing hospitals. Mm-hmm. That's
a trait. You saw the partnerships.
Absolutely central, yeah, to a land-grant approach to medicine. So that was the, you know, interesting thing going on while all the hijinks were going on.
So your role in that was important, of course.
Well, I was so adamant about not getting a hospital and making the medical school stay.
You took the lead.
Oh, absolutely. Yep. Yeah, I did. Well, and Bill Knisley did not support me in a lot of it because he felt they needed a vice president for medical affairs, which they eventually got. Mm-hmm. But, and I think they cut away too soon. I think they really need more articulation with human ecology and with public health and with the social behavioral sciences and with the business school and with engineering. See, a lot of medicine, you see, is going out into those directions. And if you're there, then they're going to have to repeat it. So if they're in the university, you can build these inner niches, which has been the power of the land-grant universities, is building those interdisciplinary things. School of Hotel and Restaurant Management. No old traditional university would add such a thing.
Right. Did that expand significantly under your tenure as provost?
What's or that?
The hotel restaurant?
Well, we helped it along, yeah.
The other areas that while you were provost, was the cyclotron an important?
Yes. Well, that really
how were you involved with that?
Well, it really got its initial start when Milt Mulder was in, and before I got started.
And he was what, vice president for graduate research?
Research.
OK. Okay.
Vice president for research.
Okay.
And later became dean of the graduate school after retirement. Mm-hmm. But the cyclotron, the part I got involved in was when they went from their initial small cyclotron to the next big one. And then I took a very active role there with Hank Blosser. And we went to NSF and argued for it. And I wheedled the matching money that the university had to have.
Mm-hmm. So your experience at, in having done research and been recognized at NSF
helped.
Probably helped.
A little, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Were you involved at all in bringing Dr. Blosser to campus, or was he already
here? No,
he
was already here. He was recruited by the former graduate dean when he was chairman of physics. Mm-hmm. And we recruited him from Oak Ridge National Lab.
I see. He was part of a higher energy physics group that was on campus?
Oh, or? Not high energy physics.
Okay,
no, nuclear physics. Yeah. And he designed the most accurately focusable small cyclotron, and that was his design. And it did a lot of very important work with light elements. And when the competition came to build the first superconducting magnets for the big heavier ions to accelerate them, you needed... If you used regular electricity, it generates so much heat that you have to have an enormous machine in order to get the power and the strength that you'd get if you now super cool, so you can get super conducting going on. Then you can have very high current levels, very high voltage levels without the heat problem. And so Hank Blosser took the lead in doing that, and he built some of the very early superconducting magnets, and we were successful in winning the first contract, which was to build the magnets for the big heavy ion accelerator without any idea where they would be located. Hmm. They were to be, it was the machine to be designed and movable. Then we had to come out with another program after we proved that the magnets worked. We had to prove that we could actually run a national laboratory here. And so we then got together some more matching money and more people who enjoyed the way Hank ran the little machine that he mm-hmm. let everybody come in with. And put the priorities in correctly.
Was that a fight at the national level to try to get that here?
Oh, absolutely.
Get it west of the Hudson, so to speak?
Oh, yeah. You bet. It was intense. Have you interviewed Hank yet?
No, not yet.
But you should.
Yeah. You're giving me 7 or 8 already.
Yeah.
That's great. Do you remember anything? Did you have to go to Washington to testify? Or did
three or four times.
Oh, you did?
Oh,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah, we
was it Department of Energy or was it NSF again? Or
both.
Combination?
Department of Energy and NSF. It was NSF early on until we won the siting of the machine. And NSF had just finished getting themselves in deep hot water with Congress because of a big overrun at Brookhaven National Laboratory in an accelerator they were building there. And so the OMB, Office of Management and Budget, decreed that NSF would not have responsibility for any more construction projects. Mm-hmm. And since the Department of Energy, the old AEC, had built all of the massive national laboratory system and the nuclear weapons facilities and so on around the country, they had great... contracting skills and so on, mm-hmm. with enormous bureaucracy built in, which is typical for federal projects, mm-hmm. which Hank Blosser could not abide.
Oh.
And so it was an enormous strain to try to get Hank and AEC, later on Energy Department, mm-hmm. to go away friends with one another on any given day.
So you again took the lead in terms of some of the administration.
We tried to argue with him what he had to do and what he didn't have to do, and try to get all of the BS out of him, out of his life, or at least most of it. Mm-hmm.
Was the cyclotron useful in any of your own research?
No. One little story about it, which is fascinating because it has had a modern counterpart story that just broke here this last year. When the magnets were operating, and we had gotten the assignment to build the actual heavy ion accelerator here. The thing about the heavy ion accelerator is that for the first time you could move heavy elements like uranium with sufficient velocity so that they would interpenetrate. Before then, you didn't have enough capacity to speed those heavy ions to the penetrating speed, because as two identically charged atoms come together, they repel. But if they're moving at such velocity, they'll penetrate. And when that happens, you get everything from fission and so on. So one of the theorists in California did some quick and dirty equations and came up with the possibility that when this heavy ion thing was fired up, it would make a mini black hole. That got people's attention.
Yeah. We wouldn't have to worry about Grand River anymore.
Or indeed the country eventually.
That's right.
Or the planet. So a couple of the physicists came over. I was vice president for research by then. And they said, what shall we do? He has made this a statement. Should we refute it? Or say that his math hasn't been reviewed and so on. I said, geez, don't say a word. We don't want anybody to even know about this. Mm-hmm. If anybody's going to know about it, let somebody else. We don't want to let anybody know about it. Let's get the best minds in the country busy trying to find out whether his calculations are correct. Mm-hmm. So they did a whole series of other calculations and said it was very, very unlikely that it would happen, very unlikely. And so I said, with that kind of assurance, we'll go ahead and fire it up. But
if we go back to your as provost, were there any? In the first year, you were provost until what year?
From 69 to 75.
Okay.
And I think my stepping down as provost has a number of elements to it. One, as I told you, I was opposed to the medical schools having their own independent vice president. I wanted them in the university. I was opposed to them having a hospital on campus. And so I think the two medical deans would just soon have a different provost.
I see. So you had some opposition there.
Oh, yeah. And, they were pretty active. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't really fully aware of this at the time, although it was beginning to be a little bit into my ideas in my head. We had been searching for Milt Mulder's replacement, who had retired as vice president for research. And I had been through all the damn student activism and so on, 75. It was just beginning to quiet down. And so I told Cliff Wharton, I said, geez, we've now interviewed three or four people for this job, and they don't want the job. They say it doesn't have any power, doesn't have any funding. It's just a damn office with very little responsibility and no money, no power to do anything. So we haven't been able to get anybody. I said, I'd much rather have that job than the provost job, which is a chief naysayer on campus, because you're trying essentially to distribute deficiencies equitably.
Interesting. Yeah.
There's never enough money to run the undergraduate program. And since my major focus was graduate programs and research had been since I came here, it was very, very difficult to try to keep things like the cyclotron and the medical schools and the outreach activity, which I was also very interested in, the cooperative extension and so on. Because I really believe in the land-grant system, always have. I'm a creature of it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the wisest invention that U.S. has made in higher education.
Interesting.
It's just a lot of reasons that that's true. And I've articulated them in a number of places. Mm-hmm. But anyway.
So Dr. Mulder's retirement?
Retirement had come. Mm-hmm. And so we needed to fill that position. And I told Cliff Horton, I'd much rather have that, because the focus of that job is to go find the funding sources off campus. Mm-hmm. And I said, geez, I'm really qualified in that area because I've worked with many of the federal agencies. Mm-hmm. And I know the Washington scene very well. And I find it very comfortable to work with business and industry. So I'd much rather have that job. And I think it made Cliff's day, because he was going to have to figure out how to tell me I was probably not going to be long for the job, but problems. Mm-hmm. But that's just a guess. He never did tell me that. Mm-hmm.
And then who replaced you as provost?
The dean of agriculture.
Okay.
What was his
name? Larry Boger?
Larry Boger, okay. Yeah. Larry Boger. Who later became the president of Oklahoma A&M. Mm-hmm.
Now, in doing some of the research for this interview, we discovered that you had been a candidate for University of Texas at Austin.
Oh, yeah.
Talk a little bit about that. Yeah. high point, low point?
Oh, yeah. Well, my wife is a Texan, mm-hmm. and I had spent a couple of years in the Navy in Texas, so I knew Texas. Had even thought at one time that we might retire down there, because she had a lot of family there. Much longer golf season.
Okay. San Antonio's nice.
Yeah. I let them put my name in. I had not allowed many other places to put my name in, although later I did. So they put my name in, and actually, the fellow who had initially suggested they contact me was Johnny McKetta, who was the dean. He was an assistant or vice president for research. No, not vice president for research. Anyway, he was dean and then later got into central administration. I don't remember his title. But he's a chemical engineer, Johnny McKetta. And he and I had served on national committees together, so we knew one another, liked one another, had a lot of fun together. Mm-hmm. And so he had put my name in as a possible candidate. So the Board of Trustees asked me if I'd be willing to have my name in, and would I send my VT and so on. And so after I talked with my wife, she was delighted with the idea. Take her back down to her home.
Michigan climate.
Right.
Escape that.
So anyway, after they had reviewed my VT and so on, I was on the short list. Two of us were on the short list. And they sent a committee of the board up here. LeMather was the chairman of the board, a physician, tough old bird, and four other members. And so I took them out to lunch to the university club. And in that time, they had orange tablecloths on the sort of a bright orange tablecloth on the tables. We come in there and says, "Oh, you decorated for the University of Texas." No, not exactly. Well, anyway, we talked a little. Anyway, they were asking my views about things on education, and I talked about research and education and problem of funding the undergraduate program. And when I talked about the outreach, they said, "Well, now you have to remember, we're talking about the University of Texas, not Texas A&M." Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I said, "Yeah, I understand." But I said, universities really have to look to the publics they support and to make what they're teaching relevant to what the society is in need of. And going along, and finally he says, "Well, Dr. Cantley, what do you think about intercollegiate sports?" Well, I said, "I have to tell you, when I first came here, I never got to a football game until my department chairman told me one day that he had to discuss another program and he didn't want to miss that game. So he'd ask his wife to stay home, and I said that was my only football game that I had been to until I got into central administration. And I said, I've never been to a baseball game. I've never been to a basketball game. I said, I have been over to the hockey. Well, they didn't have hockey down there. The conversation at the table just totally changed.
Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. That was the end of the... I was no longer a candidate.
Academic versus Steve Spurr, athletics.
Steve Spurr, who was a friend of mine at the University of Michigan, took the job. Lasted him 1 year.
1 year.
He got into a flap with the head of the board. He was backing the faculty.
So while you were provost, let's go back to athletics, were some of the difficulties in the 70s that happened while you were provost, or that was discovered while you were provost?
Well, there were several things. The recruiting violations, of course, came in there. The one that struck me most interestingly was an attempt on the part of the people in the hockey, because they knew I liked hockey. And they came over to get me to waive the academic standards for some recruits they wanted. Absolutely not. Well, you know, he said, other schools do that. I said, I'm sorry. When we admit a student to Michigan State University, we admit him to the university, and he can go into any department he wants. I said, at Ann Arbor, they can admit them into an athletics program. And they can major and get their degree in athletics, but they're not able to go into arts and letters. I said, it's a different thing here. I said, so we've got to stick by our guns. If they can't hack the academic things, they don't belong here. They belong somewhere else. So I hung very tough on that, and I did that in football, too. I would not let them. They wanted a group of, say, four or five of non-conforming students. In other words, exceptions. No, thank you.
So
I was not a sympathetic academic for waiving academic standards for athletes. I just don't believe. Now I had a colleague here, Al Ballard, who unfortunately you can't interview and you should because he's dead. Al Ballard, John Hanna recruited from the Department of Management and Budget downtown, who knew the university's budget and knew the legislative process and was. Largely, he and Jack Breslin were largely successful for our success with the legislature. And Jack Breslin, of course, was a distinguished athlete. And Al Ballard was a political realist and not very sympathetic with academic, the sense of academics. And he used to argue with me when I was fighting on these admissions. John, he said, these kids don't need to master all of the academic programs. He said, they have careers in athletics, whether pro or semi-pro or in some of the support systems in athletics. He said, they're gone. They make more money than most of your academics when they get their degree. I said, I understand that, Al. But I said, we admit them with the understanding they're going to get a degree. And I said, if they can't get a degree, I'm not going to let them in. We just agreed to disagree. We're very good friends. But he was just could not understand that approach.
Sounds like, the approach to academics that you took seems like a pretty interesting, good, solid line to be able to defend.
Well, if you start edging on the end, where do you stop?
Yeah.
Is it 5, 7, 9, 12, 15, 30, 100?
Yeah, slippery slope.
Exactly.
For sure.
Why don't you start down it?
Would you talk a little bit about Dr. Horton in terms of your relationship with him? And
we are good friends still.
Uh-huh.
As a matter of fact, I had lunch with him last year. I haven't seen him yet this year. He's also writing his memoirs.
Right at this time.
Yeah. And Bob Perrin has been helping him. Have you talked to Bob?
No.
Cliff came, and he and I hit it off very well. As I told you, I had offered him my resignation. They came in because I was sure I was going to get to Walter Adams out of here. I had no commitment. I wanted to get back to my research and graduate students and my lab.
So you had a good relationship with Walter Adams?
We got along very well. Mm-hmm. We politically were very different. Mm-hmm. He was a strong liberal, pro-labor kind of guy, and mm-hmm. I was a management type.
Did Dr. Wharton delegate a lot of things to you, or in terms of management
absolutely,
style?
Absolutely, yeah. So. He delegated, and every president that we've had here delegates all of the authority and responsibility you need to run that, and then hold you accountable, which is the way you run an organization. I have to digress a little bit and talk about my first board meeting after I was appointed by Walter Adams. I came into the board meeting, and Steve Nisbet, who was a real gentleman, he had been involved in the Constitutional Convention. He was kind of Mr. Republican in the state. And he came up and he said, "I want to apologize to you, Dr. Cantlin." He said, "I was the only board member that voted against your appointment as provost." But he said, "The rationale for my voting against you had nothing to do with your qualifications, which I think are excellent." He said, "It's my